Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In his second State of the Union address, President Obama made an appeal for unity in tackling the nation's most urgent problems. He called on Congress and all Americans to work together to return the U.S. to the forefront of global competitiveness. He spoke of the need for greater investment in innovation as well as cutbacks in spending. But he did not satisfy his critics, who want deeper cuts and questioned how the seemingly conflicting goals would be achieved. Joining me in the studio, Michael Gerson of The Washington Post, John Dickerson of Slate.com, and James Thurber of the American University. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Before we begin our conversation, let's hear this one cut from the president's speech.
Half a century ago, when the Soviets beat us into space with the launch of a satellite called Sputnik, we had no idea how we would beat them to the moon. The science wasn't even there yet. NASA didn't exist. But after investing in better research and education, we didn't just surpass the Soviets. We unleashed a wave of innovation that created new industries and millions of new jobs. This is our generation's Sputnik moment.
James Thurber, what did that mean to you?
Well, that meant that he was trying to channel John F. Kennedy. And John F. Kennedy said, we do hard things, that the Soviet Union is ahead of us in the space race. We have a clear threat from the Soviet Union, the clear mission, go to the moon. We had lots of interest groups in favor of that, by the way, then. Lots of funding, low unemployment, and Kennedy was the central core of authority. This is a little different. I mean, we have very complex problems. We don't have consensus about the problems. We don't have consensus about the mission. We have interest groups fighting with each other. We don't have enough funds. And the president is not the core of authority the way Kennedy was at that time.
John Dickerson.
It was interesting that what the president was trying to do is give that sense of moment to part of the speech was naming the current hinge in our cultural history we're in and our economic history, trying to give a sense of urgency. The problem, of course, is that Sputnik was about the threat to our safety and security and whether this would allow Soviets to have enough technology to send missiles over here, which is a little more dire than the current situation. But the president was also tapping into that response, that American sense of determination and optimism, and we can lick any problem. It's interesting. The president actually unveiled this in a speech in North Carolina last year, when he talked about test scores in China being the best in the world and that this was a wake-up call. And the speech was ignored in part because he said it on the day he was announcing the deal with Republicans on the Bush tax cut, which gives you just a sense of sometimes you can say something and it's not heard and then you unveil it somewhere else and it meets its moment.
Michael Gerson.
Well, it's a theme that I think effectively allowed him to be upbeat and forward-looking. It also embodied an outreach to the business community, which I think is a real turn. The heroes of the speech were small businessmen. The tone was quite different from, you know, attacking fat cats, and now they're very much long-lost friends. It has this advantage, having worked on some State of the Union addresses. A lot of the role he defined for government, a lot of the investments in education, technology, and competitiveness have a 20-year time frame of success. And, I remember Bush, George W. Bush in 2006, his entire economic portion of the speech was a competitiveness initiative. And I worked on that speech. I have absolutely no idea whether it did anything at all. So it's a theme that I think is a good rhetorical theme. It's hard to say that it's going to create jobs in the short term.
John Dickerson, I know you went back to listen to or read the Wilson State of the Union address. Question, do these speeches make a difference?
Well, historically, the Wilson speech was the first one. He delivered it in person in 1913 after a long period where presidents would just mail it up, which allowed them to be about sometimes as long as 22,000 words. Wilson was about 3,500. They come in now at anywhere between 5 and 6. I think the president's was closer to 6,000. Clinton, of course, the whopper at 9,000 in 1995. Historically, they're fascinating. Wilson goes on for paragraphs about farmers, which it was much more agrarian country. Then there was one Clinton speech that changed his political dynamic. The polls went up afterwards. But I think mostly you get a little bit of president gets a little bit of a bump by just if they can embrace their role. But it then dissipates and we go back to the conversation that existed before him. But I think as a framing document, the State of the Union is very powerful because it's something the president refers back to time and again throughout the year. And it's a touchstone that he can say, look, there is a point here to all of these things we're doing. You can sometimes lose the theme in a presidency. And he can, and on any day, say, hey, this may seem kind of whatever I'm doing over here may seem offline, but if you'll remember, I laid it all out in this long, organized speech, and there is a theme to this direction we're headed in.
And certainly what was interesting, Michael Gerson, is that on the one hand, the president was talking about investment or, as Republicans would put it, more spending, but on the other hand, belt tightening, no spending of any non-necessity. How do you reconcile the two, what were for you the most important themes?
Well, I think the president clearly favored one over the other. Part of what he attempted to do, and I think rather successfully, was to say we can create jobs and compete with China. His second job was to say we're going to avoid the fate of Greece. With kind of sovereign debt crisis and inflation and a lot of other things. I don't think he succeeded very much at all. I don't even think he intended to in the last section. There's very little innovative on the deficit. He talked about a five-year budget freeze. Last year, State of the Union proposed a three-year budget freeze. It was one of the most awkward and revealing moments because when he talked about the five-year budget freeze, no one applauded. The Democrats didn't applaud. The Republicans didn't applaud. And he was very and purposely vague on Medicare and Social Security, which is the real deficit problem. He was essentially telling Republicans, you go first. He didn't show a lot of presidential leadership on that. I don't think he intended to. I don't think he wanted to take that risk in the State of the Union address. So I think he did rather well on one of those themes and not so well on the other.
Jim Farber.
The five-year freeze in the budget affects only about 12% of the budget. It doesn't have a major impact. The thing that he didn't focus on were the proposals from the Deficit Debt Commission. He really didn't endorse any of them. And if you want to change the deficit and ultimately the debt in the United States, you have to deal with entitlement programs and tax increases. And he didn't talk about either one of those. When he talked about a tax decrease for corporations, he talked about it being revenue neutral. And he said it wouldn't add anything to the deficit. That's a very hard thing to do. He's living within PAYGO, pay-as-you-go. In other words, all these increases that he wants for investment in education, technology, and infrastructure have to be paid by someone else in the budget. And the degrees of freedom in the budget are very little. 12% of the budget on the five-year freeze. That means you have to find the pay-as-you-go within that sector of the budget. He was hopeful. It's about the future. It's about cooperation and innovation. And I think that's good, but it was fairly vague and generally thematic and not focused on particular policies. And therefore, it gives him freedom in the future to negotiate with people on the Hill.
Interesting that just crossing the wire is a new estimate from the Congressional Budget Office predicting that the federal budget deficit will hit almost $1.5 trillion this year, but the Nonpartisan Budget Agency predicts the deficit will drop to $1.1 trillion next year. So the question is, I realize he didn't hit the deficit hard enough for an awful lot of people. Jim Thurber, what could he have said that would have satisfied those critics?
Well, I think he could have said that he would pick up some of the proposals from the commission. They've been around for a long time, and we've had other commissions like this. There's lots of people. And we all know that there needs to be cuts in entitlement programs or means testing as well as tax increases. But that goes after the retirees. That goes after people who do not want to have any kind of tax increase. He does talk about tax reform, but he didn't get specific about that.
But he couldn't, could he? I mean, you don't do that in a State of the Union.
Politically, it's deadly. And politically, it's tough if you're going into a session where one house is the Republicans and the other house the Democrats. And he had a historic 97% presidential support score, batting average. That's going to drop down to the 30s probably because of this divided party government. And going into that negotiation, you don't want to be too specific at this point.
John Dickerson.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what Michael has to say about the President Bush talked a great deal about his plan for Social Security in a State of the Union, but the president didn't want to get specific, as Mike said, in this instance.
John Dickerson, he's chief political correspondent for Slate.com, CBS political analyst and contributor. The phones are open. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back. We were talking about last night's State of the Union speech, and of course, there was not just one response, but two responses. Michael Gerson, a response from Michelle Bachmann?
Mm-hmm. Yes, which did not make the Republican Party very happy. It shows that the Tea Party doesn't really care what the Republican leadership has to say. They would certainly have preferred a unified response to the State of the Union. And, Paul Ryan really spoke for the party. Bachmann was, showing divisions within the Republican Party. I think it's a bad sign for the future, for the Republican leadership, that a significant portion of the new members coming in have very little investment in what their leaders say or think. And that could be a real challenge.
I agree with that. I think that the Republicans have been terrific these last 2 years by having a clear message, no, no, no. And now they have several messages going on, and Boehner has to go to the right to pick up these new freshmen, these new Tea Group people, and they're very different than the mainline leadership. And I think he's doing a pretty good job so far, but the real test will be on the debate over what we should do about the debt and the deficit, about whether we really cut the budget $100 billion, whether they support a debt limit bill in March, they, meaning the far right. I think the Republicans have serious problems in the House, not in the Senate.
John Dickerson.
I agree with all of this. I think when you listen to Michelle Bachmann, it was essentially the same message Paul Ryan was offering. That wasn't really the problem in this instance. It was, you know, she didn't, it muddled the message. It got in the way. It gave the press a story to write about this internal division. And it was the tougher and more interesting battle will, though, come on the question of what to cut. And a lot of conservative Tea Party members of Congress have put out their own cuts, about $2.3 trillion over 10 years. And that's a little too fast, it seems, for Republican leaders so far. And that's where it's an actual challenge to the establishment. This was a challenge in that it muddied the message, but the message was, in fact, the same. What will be interesting is when the Tea Party actually says, you know, what the Republican leaders are doing is not enough.
But, you know, the message of the assembled there was they were respectful. There was more cooperation. It looked like there was going to be bipartisanship. And I think that Boehner wanted to have that message also, that we'll have battles in the future. And she was really off message that way. I mean, it was really a campaign speech, calling it Obamacare and really digging at the president and the Democrats.
She was also off camera because she was speaking to her web group and the television camera was off to the side. So it seemed rather awkward. Here's an email from Victoria who says the pessimistic tone of Paul Ryan's response was in stark contrast to the president's remarks. Who do the Republicans think will embrace such negativity? Michael Gerson.
Well, it depends on who you think is right. You know, Paul Ryan made a substantive critique. He thinks that we're in an emergency. We're headed towards a kind of a serious governing crisis that affects the nature of our government. And he, you know, is proposing a starkly different philosophy. The president didn't agree with that. It was much more business as usual, that we can make changes around the edges, and that we can, you know, bring, you know, a new focus on competitiveness and make this kind of, you know, not have to make the kind of fundamental change that we might have thought on in November. So, you know, it's a substantive issue, not a stylistic one.
Michael Gerson, as a former speechwriter, presidential speechwriter, do you agree with the fact that President Obama spoke so little regarding Afghanistan?
Well, I thought that was a significant admission in the speech. If you look at the text, there was almost as much on community colleges as there was in an active war that America is involved in. And I think that you can make the case that this has been a problem for Obama, is that he has not provided much inspirational rhetorical leadership in a situation where, even by the administration own account, America is going to be there at least till 2014 in significant numbers. I think he needed to do more to build public support for a policy that doesn't have much public support.
John Hickerson.
I think the White House made this choice, which was basically to leave out there were some criticisms the president should have addressed gun control in some fashion or gun violence in some way.
After talking about what happened in Tucson.
And I think and they left out some things. And in fact, in talking to advisors before the speech, they said there will be people who will be unhappy about things not in the speech, but we wanted to focus it on the economy. In some sense, using the disappointment people would feel about either not enough talk about Afghanistan or not talking about guns as a way to say, hey, but we're really focused on the economy, which used to be a knock against the president that he was not sufficiently focused on that issue.
You know, he only spent 10 minutes on foreign policy and the military. And there was really only a couple of sentences on Afghanistan. He did promise to redeploy troops in July 2011. There'll be a major confrontation, I think, between Republicans and the president on that. But realize that a significant portion of the progressives, the liberals in America, are very upset with him about Afghanistan. I think he decided not to stick a stick in that beehive with this presentation and to focus on domestic job creation, innovation, education, investment in the long term and getting our economy turned around, which is an international issue also. Because it's about competition with China and India by doing better here.
I think it's worth also noting that there were two other significant omissions given his past record. One of them is the president essentially gave up on a cap-and-trade climate bill. There was no mention of that. It's not realistic anyway, but he didn't feel the need to even make a rhetorical feint. And the other one is closing Guantanamo Bay. There was no mention of that. That's been a key presidential theme, but that now is very unlikely. And in fact, the administration has signaled they're going to resume military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. And so those were just concessions to reality. I don't fault him on those things, but they were significant.
But he did talk about the tax breaks for oil companies, did he not?
That's a very good populist issue for him, and I thought that was effective.
Although he didn't talk about the oil spill, which used to be the only thing anybody was ever focused on. And again, this is another area where usually in a State of the Union, everybody it's got everything in it, and you got to touch every base, and there are lots of bases they didn't touch. He talked about the tax breaks for oil companies as a trade-off for lowering corporate taxes so that it all can be deficit neutral.
He also talked about ending the Bush tax cuts.
Yes, realize that in 2012, those tax cuts end, as well as the estate tax. So there's going to be a big battle over tax reform generally over the next 2 years. It's going to be very hard. But back to cap and trade and environment, he talked about the other side of it quite a bit, and that is energy. Clean energy is the other side of climate change. And so he spent a lot of time on that, a way to create jobs to clean up the environment. But he didn't talk about cap and trade. People don't even know what it is, that term in most cases, or the environment.
All right. We've got lots of callers waiting. Let's hear what our listeners think about the President's State of the Union address. Good morning, Cynthia in Cincinnati. You're on the air.
Yes. Something that really bothered me was, and I don't know who does the decision on this, you had two Republican responses. Last time I looked, Michelle Bachmann was elected as a Republican also. And if the public keeps hearing the same negativity over and over again, and they heard it twice last night, it sticks. And it bothers me. And I'm wondering who made the decision that allowed them to have two responses.
Jim Thurber.
Well, I want to remind you that, and you know this, that media are. It's plural. And we have freedom of the press. There are many other responses that came out from other people. These were handled on national media, so editors were making those decisions. But we have freedom of speech. We have freedom of the press. And they decided in some studios and some networks to cover both of these. But you know what Michelle Bachmann was doing? She symbolically was doing this by directing towards a webcam to her followers, and she has a national campaign going on. She wants to be president of the United States, and she was using this forum that way to the ire, probably, of the Republican leadership that wanted to have a clear strategy, theme, and message on this, and they didn't have it at the end.
Could the Republican leadership have said to her, no, you may not do this? What could have been her response, Michael?
The Republican leadership, I don't believe, could have said no without riling the new members, the new Tea Party members that are coming to Washington, and there are quite a few of them. So it's not a fight they wanted to have, but they certainly did not want that to happen.
All right, to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Uma.
Hello, Diane. Thanks for having me on the show.
Surely.
I wanted to bring up a point that I don't think y'all have discussed so far, and that's the issue that he spoke about with immigration, especially with trying to retain skilled students that come to the United States for higher education. And immigration is always a hot-button topic, especially when everybody lumps it together with illegal immigration, and that's really close to my heart because I came here as a student after finishing medical school in 2002 and have since then been in training, and now I'm soon to be a practicing cancer physician and oncologist. And I've been waiting in the so-called line to obtain my green card or permanent residency since 2005. My number finally came up in 2010, and I haven't heard back from the USCIS, which is the immigration service, since July of last year. So I just wanted to put out there how frustrating it is for a lot of legal immigrants that are trying to make this country their home, and I think I would fall into the so-called skill category just based on my qualifications.
Well, I must say to you, congratulations, Uma. What about this situation, Jim Thurber?
Well, this is something that's also very important to business. Bill Gates comes here once a year probably to talk about the need to keep good people here that are immigrants, but also bring new skilled people into our businesses that he needs, other businesses want. But he also said in the statement, and it set an agenda item, that he wants to talk about an immigration bill that has security for our borders and a pathway to citizenship. And this particular issue was brought out as very important to business, to higher education, and to immigrants that would like to stay here that are very skilled.
James Thurber of American University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Michael Gerson, did you want to add to that?
Well, I do think that the president made a strong endorsement of the DREAM Act, which is they voted on in the last Congress. It was not successful. And I think, unfortunately, these are people who are here and deserve to be treated in that manner. I question whether the mention of immigration reform is going to go very far in this Congress. And unfortunately, I think that Republicans are going to be very resistant and that this may be a much more symbolic placeholder rather than a serious proposal. That would be a very tough set of issues for this Congress to deal with.
Exactly, and is some sense of how difficult it is. The president didn't address it directly. He came in through education, which is to say it was a part of his larger argument, long-term, future-oriented argument about investment in education infrastructure. And so immigration came in under that umbrella as if to sort of repackage it as an economic jobs argument rather than the human rights and other kinds of arguments that have been used. But I think Michael's right in terms of the politics, even with a new kind of topic sentence, it still has a difficult road ahead of it.
And now to Ozark, Arkansas. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning, Diane. I was wondering, I don't have a lot of education. I've been to high school, a little bit of college, and I studied some economics. It's our taxes, our federal income tax, is as low as it's been since the Truman era. It doesn't make sense to me how we're going to dig ourselves out of this hole. Would we ever made what we made in the 50s and 60s, the bright light on the hill, if these higher-end income taxes would have been this low? Would we ever gotten all the roads built and the things done? Why don't they just go back to the 50s tax codes and see how that works again?
Good question.
Mike, you're from Arkansas, and Arkansas went broke in the 30s, and you see what happens when a place goes broke, and they had low taxes then to try to attract business. Taxes are at a historic low, and I think that there was consensus on the Commission on Debt and Deficit, even from Paul Ryan and other Republicans, that, boy, we really have to reform the tax code. What's that mean? It means we have to have some higher taxes for some people, and maybe we shouldn't write off the mortgage above $700,000, which is part of that. And I think that has to be on the table. When they look at the so-called Bush tax cuts coming up in 2011 and 12, they will be looking at this yet again. They didn't do the brave thing, though, and tax higher incomes, $250,000 above, at a higher rate. I think they have to think about that.
And Joe in Marianna, Florida, writes, if Obama wants to level the playing field, I'll know he's telling the truth if he establishes a flat tax for rich and poor. any chance of that, Michael Gerson?
No, not from the current administration. He wants to make the system marginally more progressive, not greatly more progressive. There's very few people in American politics that would want to return to 90% tax rates, which we had after World War II. They were generally seen as negative. It was John Kennedy that wanted to decrease tax rates in order to get more economic growth. That's what he campaigned on. And I think we've had a revolution in the way that that's viewed. I think it's also fair to say that the Republican spending cuts that they proposed, where the realistic tax increases, have very little to do with the long-term deficit problem. I mean, we have a problem of increasing health care costs, an aging population, and expansive entitlements. If that problem is not solved, we're not going to stabilize federal spending at a realistic percentage of the economy.
But, Michael, aren't you leaving out the cost of two wars?
Yeah, the president proposed defense cuts last night, and I think Secretary Gates has realized that some of that is going to be unavoidable. But I don't think that explains our long-term deficit problem either.
Very quickly, Jim.
Yes, this is the first war that we haven't taxed for, Iraq and Afghanistan, and no one says let's tax for the war. It's too deadly in terms of votes, in my opinion.
Jim Thurber of American University, Michael Gerson, Washington Post columnist, John Dickerson of Slate.com. More of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
J.D. Salinger was one of 20th century America's most popular and reclusive literary figures. A new biography offers insights into the life of the author of The Catcher in the Rye, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Gilbert, and apparently several emails like this. Gilbert says, I don't get it. Last month we were told the world would come to an end if the Bush-era tax cuts were not extended. Now, 4 weeks later, we're told the end is near if budget deficits are not abruptly reduced. Which is it? John Dickerson.
It's both, because the time frames are different. So the argument for the tax cut was that this is necessary for the short term. With the economy in a difficult position, it would have been too much of a shock to let these rates go up on the wealthy. And for the short term health of the economy, they had to basically agree to this deal to increase the budget deficit. But as a long term problem, because of entitlements, growing population, and inflation, mostly associated with healthcare costs, that is a growing, mushrooming problem that has to be addressed, or it will eat up the economy.
All right, to Apex, North Carolina. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thank you. I watched the State of the Union last night on C-SPAN, and they broadcast all of the tweets that the congressmen were doing while the speech was going on, and I was appalled at how rude, in the air of bipartisanship, how rude the criticisms were of the president, and that they were being broadcast at the same time that the speech was going on.
Give me an example, David.
Ron Brown, MD, I believe, from South Carolina. The president would say one thing about tax cuts, and he said something like, "The president doesn't want that. He only believes in socialism." Or at one point, he called the president a liar. And these people are congressmen.
Well, so much for the seating arrangement and bipartisanship. Michael Gerson.
Well, I think it's fair to say that congressmen have private thoughts that are probably best kept private.
Exactly.
That we don't want to know. Certainly there is an element of the Republican Party, and you saw in the Bachman speech that blame Obama pretty much for everything. Paul Ryan, by the way, didn't do that. He distributed the blame more broadly on both parties. And so I do think the seating arrangement, though, worked in one way. It ended the herd dynamic of these pop-up, competing applause sections. It also made it reduced the energy level of the speech. There wasn't as much as you'd normally have. And as a former speechwriter, I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually think that puts more emphasis on the words than the kind of team competition for the night. So I actually thought that it was a good innovation.
Didn't it actually reduce the number of ovations, either standing or seated?
I think it decreased the kind of energy and intensity of reactions to the president's remark, basically because if you're sitting in a group of like-minded people who jump up at the slightest notice, you get more standing ovations. You get more intense reaction. But I just think that that's been a bad thing, a symbol of polarization, not a good thing.
But like Michelle Bachman, isn't Ron Brown simply tweeting to his own following?
Well, I think that he's tweeting to his own following, and I think tweets are dangerous sometimes because you express things immediately and then later you don't really believe in it, and I think that's not very good. But, there were 75 times that there was an applause this time from both sides, and this was professorial Obama. I mean, he was explaining things in great detail, and they were actually listening. And I kept thinking, as a professor, I don't want my class on the left jumping up and applauding and on the right jumping up and applauding. I like applause, but, I want them to think about the content. And this mingling of Republicans and Democrats was very good. It's long overdue to have more civility and comity. And there was that at that level. The far left and far right were probably tweeting things that were really out of the main line. And I think we should focus on what happened. It was the first time since I've been watching this, and I worked on the Hill for many years, that I've seen this. And it's terrific, in my opinion.
Why don't they ban tweeting during the speech?
They've just made it more liberal, which is to say that you can bring in the devices were previously.
I think they ought to ban them.
Well, I think people are, free speech is still something we believe in.
Is one thing, but the presidential State of the Union is something else, and you've got members of Congress sitting there supposedly respectful of
but
the
if they are not
of the free world.
But if they are not respectful, and that's something we value as a society, then they'll be penalized for it or applauded, as Joe Wilson was when he shouted out, "You lie," which is much more powerful than some random thing. I mean, I think that if it is perfectly good and right and just to judge them on their inability to keep their mouths shut, whether it's out loud or in a tweet, if they are so unrestrained that they can't keep it buttoned for a period of time, then perhaps they shouldn't hold office or they should be a carny barker.
Here's another question from Rick and Linda, who want to know why were only two-thirds of the Supreme Court present. Who was absent? What kind of a statement are they trying to make? John Dickerson.
Well, Samuel Alito was absent. There's a lot of rich texture to this, but he had a previous engagement in Hawaii that he couldn't break. But you'll remember in the State of the Union where the president singled out the Supreme Court for its decision on Citizens United case and criticized the court. And Samuel Alito said that the president was not he mouthed not true or not right. And according to the reports, even the liberals on the bench were a little taken aback by the fact that the president was singling out the court. They have this very strange role they play in the theater, or the old theater of the State of the Union. They have to sit mute with their hands in their lap. They don't engage in any of the popping up and the down and all of that nonsense. And so they are sort of sitting ducks. The president went after them. Turns out he may not have, in fact, been right in his criticism, which is also a little tricky. And so there was that. And John Roberts subsequently said, you know, this was unfortunate, kind of question whether they should go at all. Justice Scalia has called it a charade and a show. But after all of that, six of them showed up, and it all things seemed to have been repaired a little bit. Although the president made no overture to them to kind of bury the hatchet, but the fact that they showed and nobody got hurt is
was
probably...
Justice Clarence Thomas in the audience.
Justice Thomas wasn't there. He usually doesn't attend. Scalia doesn't usually attend. And there's sometimes when there's only one justice there, if you look at it historically, they don't always show up. This time it was important to see what they would do because Roberts made a statement that it was like a pep rally and a lot of people felt that maybe he wouldn't come. He made a decision to come to represent that branch, even though maybe he disagreed with the environment of it. But frequently, there are only three or four justices there, if you look back historically.
I thought it was interesting that Justice Thomas was not there, considering the recent news that his wife's near $700,000 income had not been included on his tax forms. That seemed a little curious to me.
Well, he has said that there was a misunderstanding about recording his wife's income. He has never done that since he's been on the Supreme Court. The $700,000 recently was recorded coming from the Heritage Foundation over the last 4 years, but she's had all kinds of other income. He's now submitted that. I have to believe that he did misunderstand that because he never recorded her income from the very beginning.
Curious. Let's go to Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick comment in regard to, first off, I'm a single parent, and I very much feel that I must be responsible for my budget and the money that I borrow and so forth and so on. But I also feel that I'm part of a growing number of Americans who feel that there's just a large disconnect with my government in regard to, you know, we came through a period of 8 years where the government seemed more than willing to borrow an enormous amount of money to fight a war that was very questionable. And now what we're hearing is the government seems to be very responsible about cutting everything they possibly can for Americans. This recent thing with the 9/11 responders, the Republicans holding that up and then cutting it in half, which I thought was abhorrent, and then holding up, you know, the extension for the unemployment benefits. These are American citizens. And, you know, I find that it is it's just abhorrent to me.
Michael Gerson.
Well, I mean, I understand the sentiment. It's very hard to argue in the last 2 years that America's been stingy. We have a situation where in 750 days, President Obama has presided over an addition of more than $3 trillion to the national debt. He was proposing last night, some of his proposals were really in the range of $400 billion reductions. This is, I understand the sentiment, But right now, we're in an unsustainable budget situation. Republicans and Democrats are going to have to take that seriously. That's not going to just involve defense cuts. It's also going to involve broad cuts in other areas. And I think everyone recognizes that, but don't really want to do much about it.
Well, I think what a lot of people forget is in the first few months of the Bush administration, I'm sorry, I have to go back to that, the last Bush, we had a projected $3.4 trillion surplus. We had 4 years of surplus before that, and we had tax cuts at that point that wiped out that $3.4 trillion. The hypothesis was that we were going into a recession, and he prevented it. So in a shorter period of time, $3.4 trillion was used in tax expenditures under the Bush administration, and we're still living with that right now.
To Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Joe. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I would agree with that. Part of the problem was going to be with this tax reform issue. I don't believe we're going to have any tax reform issues as long as we have unserious people like the Tea Party involved. I fault CNN, quite frankly, for even broadcasting that speech. To me, that's just ridiculous. I agree with wholeheartedly with John's partner in crime at Slate, Christopher Hitchens. These are the most unserious group of people. They never, ever speak of foreign policy. All they do is complain. And to give them a voice, I have zero issue with her having a voice on a webcam. But to give a national voice to these people is sheer ridiculousness.
John Dickerson.
Well, let's look at it just from the media perspective. So the Tea Party in the last election, the animating force of the Republican movement was a group of populist grassroots activists who defeated the establishment Republican candidates in a lot of very interesting places. In one case, defeated the hand-picked candidate of the Senate leader for the Republicans. And this movement, which came sort of out of nowhere, has very interesting contours, helped shape the last Republican victory. It is now creating a tension in the new Republican leadership in the House. This is a big story, and it's an interesting story. Now, the press goes overboard in kind of seeing this story everywhere and kind of amping it up when it's a slow news day about the tensions and the problems. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they aren't. But it is a story, and a story that has to be covered.
John Dickerson of Slate.com, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Confusing times, Diane. I get very confused about what's happening here in America. We keep hearing that we need to cut jobs, we need to cut government, we need to cut pensions, we need to cut Social Security, Medicare, all across the board, local and national. But then they turn around and they say that we need to increase spending, we need to go out and do things, to buy things, so that that we just create more jobs that way. But if we're going to put all these people out of work and put them in unemployment, how do you go about addressing that problem?
You certainly pinpoint the tension, Michael.
It is the tension, and it's really the context of the president's remarks last night. He was making an argument that we do need to make cuts in the short term, but we can't get rid of those long-term engines of economic growth. In fact, he talked about it as the engine in the airplane, spending money on education, spending money on research and development, spending money on infrastructure, those three in particular. He's defined a role for government that said that government needs to catalyze the private sector, kind of create the conditions that allow it to succeed. That's very much like Bill Clinton's argument that he made. The question is whether he's taking the fiscal emergency seriously enough, whether that approach is sufficient to the time. Republicans don't think so, but the president clearly does.
He calls it investment, and Republicans call it spending.
This is the great philosophical debate we're going to have, because Republicans believe that these nudges, and it was interesting in the way Obama framed these things, they were challenges to business to be innovative, nudges to let states change and improve their education. He said, if you come up with an innovative way of teaching, we'll give you the money. But it was not, we're going to tell you exactly what to do. So an attempt to deal with the immediate charge that it's top down. Republicans believe, just strip government get it out of the way, remove these regulations, lower taxes, and let industry pick and choose the most innovative. It can do it much more efficiently, and it can allocate capital in a smarter way if you just get government out of the way. And that is the philosophical debate we're going to have for the next 2 years.
And the question becomes, can the president use his bully pulpit to go over the heads of Republicans straight to the people and achieve what he wants to achieve.
That's what the speech was about. It was geared to the center. It was geared to, we want to win in the future. We want to invest in these education infrastructure and innovation to help things get going. It was geared towards business. He wasn't on the far left. He was geared where the voters are, not where the House and the Senate is, because we've got people on the far left and far right really driving things in the House in particular. And the endangered species in Congress is not the polar bear. It's a moderate. And he was going after the moderates in the electorate, not the moderates on the Hill. And that's where we'll find the confrontation over the next few months.
Do you believe that, Michael Gerson?
I do believe that it was a speech very much that would please the dial groups, the people in focus groups that make these decisions. I mean, if you say enough positive, hopeful things, people, tend to like it. The question here that Republicans are raising, is he confronting the big problems?
Michael Gerson, Washington Post columnist, former speechwriter for George W. Bush. John Dickerson is chief political correspondent for Slate.com, also a CBS political analyst and contributor. James Thurber is professor and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. His book, Obama in Office, The First 2 Years, will be coming in March. Thanks to all of you, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.